themes, and I should say that this is not an exhaustive look at extraterrestrial intelligence in science fiction. I did hopefully embark upon a project this summer of watching as many films as I could with my 12-year-old, and we didn't get through them all. And so I recognize that this is a huge genre that I have only scratched the surface of. But in considering some of the more important works in science fiction, actually not all of which have been made into films, I think you can see that there is great interest in this question of how religion comes into science fiction. And these are just some of the themes, and we won't touch on most of these, but and there may be themes that you recognize in film that you don't see on this list. But they are dealt with and in a very imaginative and interesting way. So my working assumptions, scientifically, and I won't even go through these, I won't comment on them, but I recognize that there are working assumptions we make when we think about extraterrestrial intelligence. And these are some of them. I put a qualification to this one because I know that there is speculation about whether, in fact, the universe is similar throughout. But it seems to me that if we are going to find ET, there would have to be some similarity. It may be that only a small percentage of stars harbor life-capable planets, but one planet did give rise to life. And therefore, it seems to me that life may have arisen elsewhere. Also, I've been doing some reading on how life may be unrecognizable to us, or it may be recognizable, but it may be very anthropocentric and carbonocentric of us to assume that life will be carbon-based like we are. My working assumption also leads me to believe that we may never find out about other instances of life. Whole civilizations may have come into being and gone out of existence 1 million or 10 million years ago. There is, of course, a window within which evolving life has to happen because for the first 4 or 5 billion years of the universe, there don't seem to have been sufficient number of first-generation stars to give rise to the kinds of elements we need to form second-generation stars. So there is a window, but nevertheless, we may never find out about this. Even so, I think it is theologically not pointless to consider the implications of extraterrestrial life for Christian theology. In fact, I think that considering that the universe does not revolve around one particular religious vision of one tribe of Homo sapiens may be essential to the continuing of religious belief into the third millennium. This is the Drake equation, which I won't even go into, but Frank Drake and later people in SETI articulated this equation for how they came up with the number of possible habitable stars or habitable planets in our galaxy, and I think we came up with between 127 and 245. But, of course, that changes weekly as we find more exoplanets out there. I always like infusing a little bit of humor in here, and this cartoon by a physicist struck me as very interesting, that Goldilocks is quite wrong in terms of thermodynamics. So what about extraterrestrial intelligence in the Western tradition? There's been a lively debate for 2,000 years, and some of the big books on this are Stephen Dick's Plurality of Worlds, Michael Crow's The Extraterrestrial Life Debate, and Stephen Dick's edited book, Many Worlds, The New Universe, Extraterrestrial Life and Theological Implications, which is a very interesting work that I have hardly begun to digest. From antiquity to the Middle Ages, there was lively discussion of the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. But then Aristotle came along and ruled that out, arguing that only one world is possible because each element has a natural place, and the natural place of Earth is at the bottom, at the center of the universe. And therefore, no other Earth-like element could exist above that. Thomas Aquinas maintained this denial. However, in 1277, in the condemnations of various issues, the Bishop of Paris said that the Aristotelianizing arts masters could not constrain what God might do, And so Proposition 27A says one may not, condemns the idea, says one may not hold that the first cause cannot make more than one world. Aquinas and Aristotle had said that God could not make more than one world. The effect of the condemnation was to limit Aristotle and lead to the modern debate.
Make sure you don't run out of battery power.
Ah, thank you. That would be very, very problematic. And as Stephen Dick says, it's one of the great ironies of history that while the passionate atomist appeal to plurality of worlds fell on deaf ears, it was the rejection of that idea by the dominant Aristotelian worldview that led to the critical discussion of plurality of worlds in the later centuries. So you have Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa arguing that God may be compared to a sphere whose center is everywhere and circumference is nowhere. It may be conjectured that in the area of the sun there exist solar beings, while the ones in the moon are possibly lunatics, while those on Earth are more gross and material. That was before lunatic carried a negative connotation. In the Renaissance, we've got Galileo arguing that if there were many universes, each Earth would move to the center of its own universe. Leonardo, it's a manifest sign that the moon is surrounded by its own elements. Leonardo considered the possibility of life on the moon. And Nehemiah Grew, a member of the Scientific Revolution in England, argued that the moon and the planets are Earths, and that every fixed star is a sun surrounded by planets. So we get teleology in here, that there's purposiveness in the universe. And I was trying to find this great quote by an Anglican who said, you can't really imagine, can you? You can't really argue, can you, that all those stars in the universe, in the sky, were made just to twinkle at us, suggesting that they have a much bigger purpose than merely supporting humanity. Of course, there is, in the Western tradition, there has long been room for non-material beings in the form of demons and angels. And moving to contemporary film, it's interesting to me that there seems to be a disjunction between the way in which extraterrestrial life is portrayed. Often it's portrayed as monstrous or demonic. And a curious fact, and I was just talking with the fellow who gave the plenary address, the filmmaker whose name I've forgotten, Bob Winter, why it is that in Galaxy Quest and other films, all the really horrible aliens have British accents. Where that convention started. Well, it wouldn't do to give them a Nigerian or a Chinese accent, and probably most people would think it's ho-hum if it were an American accent, but listen next time to an alien film and the really evil characters have British accents.
It's not just aliens, it's a lot of bad guys.
That's true. Well, he said the British are better actors. He also, he was quoting some film in which the Germans, a World War II film in which the Germans have British accents, so I apologize on behalf of Americans. I don't know whether Alien has an accent or not, but anyway, you get the idea. Also, they're often portrayed as reptilian or arthropodic, not generally as mammalian. Then you have the whole genre of E.T. is benign or morally superior, from Klaatu, the scientific savior, to E.T., to Yoda, the wise alien, the benign alien Starman, who has wondrous powers. The very wise, knowing aliens in Close Encounters, which we don't really get much of a sense into their personhood about. And then you've got the middle category. E.T. is morally ambiguous. Jareba Shigan from Enemy Mine, he's a Drac. He is a reptilian who turns out to be good. Paul, my 12-year-old Robert, really loved this film. There are so many swear words in it. And it is a very funny film. So I guess that's about all I can contribute about Paul to this discussion. All right, I think there are some good themes that are made, but if you haven't seen Paul, rent it. Well, he says, the two British actors, one of them says, are you going to probe us now? And he says, why do you guys always think you're going to be probed? And then he comes back with some bagels on his finger and says, anybody want bagels? Okay, so you've got Star Wars, more morally ambiguous characters who are neither obviously good nor obviously evil. and Avatar, although some could argue that they were more benign than morally ambiguous. I just watched District 9 for the first time this week and found it a very interesting film. And in literature, and I was talking with Paul Lang about this at lunch, if you haven't read Mary Doria Russell's book, The Sparrow, you really should. It's a very disturbing novel. It's about the first Jesuit mission to a planet. And Emilio Sandoz is the protagonist whose moral world comes apart when he discovers that there are two rational species on the planet Rakat 4, one of which serves as food for the other. And he cannot plug this into his Christian view of God's loving purposes. It's a very interesting story. And Paul was suggesting I read the sequel, which is called what?
Children of God.
He goes back. I thought he was never going to go back. Anyway, it's kind of a horrific story, but really wonderful. So, predation. Predation is something we're all aware of. And it seems to me that and I'm going to argue that extraterrestrial would be morally ambiguous like us. It's more than likely that ET life would have evolved within an ecological web of predator-prey relationships reflecting an evolutionary morality, moral ambiguity within a widening circle of ethical inclusion. And one of the things that breaks apart the world of Rakat 4 is that when Emilio Sandoz begins questioning the predator-prey relationship between these two intelligent species, one of which is an obligate carnivore species, they can't live on vegetables, their world is beginning to come apart. He's trying to widen the circle of ethical inclusion. And Bob Russell, who I used to work with at the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences, wrote an article in which he argued that E.T. would almost certainly be simul justus et peccator, at once justified and a sinner, like us. So I tend to think in terms of an evolutionary hermeneutic, and Daniel Dennett has a very interesting book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, in which he articulates this statement, that evolution is an acid that eats away every traditional concept, leaving the landmarks still recognizable but transformed in fundamental ways. And I would say to a theologian, this is old news. There's nothing new about that. Theologians from the early days of the church until now have been seeing their worlds crumble as science advances, and then theology reintegrates and reincorporates ideas from heliocentricity to evolution to the unconscious. And so it is not impossible for theology to look in with new lenses. Now, I have not seen... Who said yes? I have not seen or read Jesus on Mars, but I was recommended to put this in the show. Is this something you recommend?
It's a great eye catcher. That's the kind of thing you want to have in a PowerPoint slide. Yeah.
Well, apparently it's sort of ambiguous about religion, and I included this with Dune because Dune is quite preoccupied with religion, but many of the religions are basically human. I think there are a couple of religions in Dune that mix indigenous ET religious traditions. But clearly, the preoccupation with religion is there. And the kinds of questions that are raised by science fiction are these. Would intelligent life evolve morality, religion, spirituality, theologies? Is belief in God an artifact of the evolution of consciousness, or is it our coming to recognize the existence of the creator of the universe? Could the Christ principle become incarnate elsewhere in the universe, perhaps multiple times? In the 17th century, a theologian asked whether Christ would have to be crucified multiple times if he came on multiple planets. Or would visitors to different planets recognize Jesus of Nazareth, or would we recognize their incarnation of God? Is God necessarily triune, or is that an artifact of our living in a monosolar cosmology? Would the Catholic argument that the priest is an icon of Christ must be male be undermined by a biology of female dominant intelligent species? That seems to be an argument that Protestants have already solved, but it's a live issue in my church. Would belief continue to play a role in the lives of a technologically sophisticated space-faring people? Sorry, I left off the question mark. Does religion carry survival value to evolve on another planet? What's the relationship between survival value of religious belief and the claimed truth values of religious doctrine? what might be the interface between two theological systems that come into contact. So I'm basically going to go through three questions to end here. And it's a very tantalizing and difficult thing to do because there's so much that we could talk about. The first here would be the evolution of religious consciousness. And I would argue that planets have finite energy resources. Evolving life must compete for these finite resources. As life expands into every biological niche, predation between species and competition within species will inevitably arise. Prior to the evolution of consciousness, competition is not a moral issue. When a lion tears down a gazelle and eats it, that's not a moral issue. When a primal person in a tribal setting takes more than his share of woolly mammoth in a hard winter, condemning some of the tribe to starvation, that is a moral issue, it seems to me. So it seems to me that morality evolves. We evolve into the understanding of sin sometime in the last 200,000 years, after reaching anatomical modernity and before reaching behavioral modernity. And therefore, sin, the recognition of sin, the recognition of morality, is something that has evolved. I've already mentioned Bob Russell's point here. In other words, given evolutionary differences, ET will be, in important respects, like us, both predatory and cooperative, egoistic and altruistic. Sorry, I misspelled that. Capable of evil and capable of good. And then we have the problem raised by the sparrow. Will we recognize some actions as being good or evil? When the predatory species in the sparrow eats the non-predatory species, they would not even have recognized that as a moral issue. It was not until the humans, with their human morality, arrived on Rakat 4 and began convincing the vegetarian herbivore species that perhaps they shouldn't be eaten, that they began to revolt, which overthrew the entire, not only the social order, but the biological order of what was going on Rakat 4. There's a huge literature on the evolution of religious consciousness. And we don't even have time to go into that, but it does seem to me that self-consciousness is something that has evolved in the last several hundred thousand years, and that it evolved into the practicing of birth, puberty, marriage, death rituals, the recognition of transcendence, God or gods and spirit, the search for cosmogonic explanations in the world's great religious mythical traditions, developing into into bigger and better articulated theologies during the Axial Age. I put Pache numerous ongoing studies to suggest that I don't want to rule out the possibility that non-human terrestrial animals have a spirituality. Second of the three issues. Actually, somehow when we moved from my system to Mac, it erased the title, which was, I think it was Sacramentality in the Universe.
It said it on the last
slide. It did? Okay. So this is universality of mission. Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations. Well, does that only apply to the earth, or could that apply to the rest of the universe? And Pope Benedict, in his recent book, Jesus of Nazareth, argues that the universality of Jesus' mission is made visible. Now, I'm not sure what he means himself when he says the scope is the whole of creation, whether he's simply thinking the earth and its environs, or whether he is indeed thinking of our galaxy or of the 300 billion galaxies of our universe. Through the disciples and their mission, the world as a whole is to be torn free from its alienation to rediscover unity within God. Now, a word about sacraments, and I recognize that this perhaps resonates more with those of you with a sacramental theology background, but it seems to me that sacrament as God's presence in the world, with Jesus being the primary sacrament, suggests that sacraments relate to all the important moments of the Christian life. 2 minutes? Okay. And that the material elements represent the divine presence in the cosmos. The question for our discussion here is whether this resemblance between the stages of natural life and the spiritual life would be mirrored in alien theological culture. How different might the matter be, ammonia rather than water, for example, for baptism to remain a sacrament? And here's a little cartoon where the alien has crashed on the earth in a desert. He's saying, ammonia, ammonia. So could we baptize with ammonia? Could E.T. the healer be ordained E.T. the priest? If the priest is to be an icon of Christ, what are the parameters? If the Catholic priest must be a male, must he be also a male member of the species Homo sapiens? What if the pattern of sexual dimorphism and gender dominance had evolved differently in a different extraterrestrial species? What if females were the ordained priests among non-humans? What would extraterrestrial religious imagery look like? And the final point here is incarnation and salvation. I love this quote by Karl Rahner, who says that it's especially worthy of note that the point at which God irrevocably lays hold on the totality of the world is characterized not as spirit, but as flesh. And it is this which allows us to integrate the history of salvation into the history of the cosmos, even when many questions remain unanswered. And I think that's an important thing for this entire topic. There are questions which we may never know, whether there is E.T., and yet it's important for humans to consider. Ilya Delio, who's got a doctorate in biochemistry as well as in theology, in Christ and Evolution, talks about integrating and personalizing the Logos into the cosmos. Now, a couple of problems with her approach, and that would be her approach and that of George Murphy in Cosmos and the Light of the Cross, and both are great books. I find that their soteriology, or theology of salvation, is too anthropocentric, too terracentric, and too carbonocentric. It seems to me that the Christian claim is that the death of one member of Homo sapiens has uniquely and indelibly affected the universe out of 3 times 10 to the 22nd stars. And I think theology may need to rethink theology of salvation so that it is not so anthropocentric and carbonocentric. And so that it might include cultures that would never hear about Christ because they were extinguished 300 million years ago. I'll just speed through this, but from what are we being saved? Are we being saved from our basic biology or from our sinful nature? Was there a historic fall from grace? How do we integrate biology here? Alice Meynell wrote a wonderful poem that you can Google. Just Google Christ in the Universe, and this is only 2 out of 7 stanzas, where she talks about how in the eternities we might be very surprised to find that God was incarnate in a different way, and then we in our turn show them a human being. Finally, theologies have spoken about the end of the world in many different ways, and I don't do anything other than list these, but to suggest that humans have always wondered about the far future of the universe. So my conclusion slides. We may not be alone. The universe may have given rise to other spiritually responsive beings, even though we may receive evidence or we may not. The answer, I think, would be significant either way. Either we're alone or we share the God's bounty with other creatures. The first one is reflective of a literal reading of the book of Genesis. The second is reflective of the interpretation of Revelation through our cosmological understanding. There's no reason to believe that E.T. would be incapable of moral life or spiritual response. An intelligent extraterrestrial could become a Christian. E.T. might be post-religious, and there are some who argue that that religion is something we evolve beyond. However, I will say in my final slide here that I certainly hope that the move to post-religion is not an inevitable evolutionary stage. And Andrew Louth, in Discerning the Mystery, another great book that I recommend, argues that a mystery will always be with us. It's not a problem to be solved in science. It's something to be enjoyed. So I am left apophatic, that is, without words in a sense, which maybe is a strange conclusion to have spent all this time talking about this and ultimately to be left without words. But I would say an intelligent extraterrestrial life form could become a Christian, but it might not see the point in doing so, and might not feel the need to become Christian to obtain salvation, and that might not even matter. So that's where I will leave this. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes.
So I had the occasion to put together and teach an elective course to engineers on the engineering of sustainability.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial ecology.